Meeting to order. This is the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Let the record reflect, it's approximately 1:35 p.m. Thursday, February 12th, 2009. There is a quorum present. In fact, all members of the committee are present. Senator Thomas, Senator Davis, Senator Meyer, Senator Bundy, and myself, Senator Paskfen. I would request that everyone turn off your cell phones. We've been informed that the even if they're on quiet, that when they affect the recording equipment, so even on the vibrate or quiet mode, if everyone could turn off their cell phones, please. The purpose of today's meeting is to take up two pieces of legislation, both of which are fairly significant: Senate Bill 1 relating to Alaska's minimum wage, and Senate Bill 23 relating to the repeal of the defined contribution retirement plan for public employees. And I want to thank everyone that's here personally in the committee room and those that may be online. And we will first hear from Senator Wilikowski in a moment, who will offer a brief follow-up from last week's testimony about the minimum wage bill that he has filed. And after Senator Wilikowski's remarks, we will resume public testimony. And we will do that until approximately 2:15, and then at 2:15 we'll take a brief at ease. We may before then, but certainly at 2:15, then we will begin hearing on Senate Bill 23. And I intend on Senate Bill 23 to hear from the plan sponsor, from the administration, and then there is invited expert testimony so that we can start to frame some of the issues in regards to Senate Bill 23, and then we will be adjourning at 3 o'clock as planned. So we will begin with Senator Wilikowski. If you would please identify yourself. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Wilikowski. I'm state senator for Northeast Anchorage, and I appreciate the opportunity to be back here in front of you. And Mr. Chair, I know there were some issues that were raised in the public testimony last meeting, and with your okay, I'd just like to take about 2 minutes and talk a little bit about them. These are issues that have been discussed in previous committees many times. If you're okay with that, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. You know, we do want to hear from you. I know that I've been receiving anyway a significant number of emails. I've been receiving telephone calls, so I think there are people are interested, and so I want to make sure that you have the opportunity to address us as well as the citizens of Alaska.
So. Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm happy to get the full testimony from the last time this was discussed. There was a bit of question raised about the impact on increase in the minimum wage on small business owners and business in general. And this exact question was posed by this exact committee last year when we had the minimum wage bill up last year. And we had an expert come in and testify at that time. His name is Dr. Paul Wolfson of Dartmouth College. He's written extensively on minimum wage and the impacts on industry and on employees. And he described a study by David Card of University of California, Berkeley, and Alan Krueger of Princeton University that examined fast food restaurants on either side of the Pennsylvania-New Jersey border, comparing employment before and after a minimum wage increase in New Jersey. And in that study, they found no evidence that employment in New Jersey declined after the increase. Dr. Wolfson also quoted Robert Solow, an MIT economist and Nobel Prize winner, who did similar research and concluded that, quote, "The main thing about this research is that the evidence of job loss is weak, and the fact that the evidence is weak suggests that the job loss is small." Dr. Wolfson also talked about the work of Dr. Alan Blinder, who is a Princeton economist and former vice president of the Federal Reserve System. And after much study, Dr. Blinder stated, quote, "What's changed in the last 10 to 15 years is an accumulation of evidence that the employment problem is not very significant." And the employment problem he's referring to is when minimum wage increases occur. Dr. Wolfson also reviewed research regarding federal minimum wage increases in the late 1990s. And before these increases, opponents, similar to what you're hearing, predicted massive job loss. Instead, the employment rates of lower-wage workers actually soared to unprecedented levels. Poverty levels fell to historic lows, particularly for minority populations, the least skilled workers, and single mothers. So it had really a positive impact on the exact people that we're trying to help here. All the evidence needs to be considered as we discuss increasing Alaska's minimum wage, which is lagging far behind the rate of inflation and making life difficult for our lowest paid workers. This concludes my remarks for today, Mr. Chairman, and happy to answer any questions or proceed as you will.
Yes, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Chairman. Thanks for the information. Mentioned in that one report that poverty levels fell after the increase in minimum wage. If this bill passes and it becomes law at 875, would that bring people in Alaska above poverty level?
Yes.
It would.
The poverty level for a single person is roughly $14,000, which under our minimum wage puts a person working 2,000 hours right at $14,000. This will increase it to above poverty level.
They would be briefly above poverty level.
Well, you know, it would be another $1,500 or $2,000, which I think is fairly significant.
Any other questions? I just have, if you have any comments either now or later, it seems to me that there are really three components of this. It's the rate itself, the cost of living allowance, and then the whether there is or is not a tip credit. And, you know, that's what all the calls that I'm receiving are focusing upon. And just wondering if you would speak to either the tip credit, for example, issue.
I'll speak to all three, Mr. Chair. The COLA, the tip credit, and the dollar above. And I guess just historically, Alaska has always had a higher minimum wage than the federal minimum wage. Traditionally, we have been at least 50 cents. In fact, I think our law prior to 2003 actually had a provision in there that we were either 50 cents or a dollar above the federal minimum wage. As I mentioned in my testimony last time, in July, we will no longer be at the federal minimum wage. We'll actually be below the federal minimum wage for the first time in the state's history, and we'll be number 40 in the nation in terms of the minimum wage that we provide our lowest income citizens. And so I feel very strongly about having some sort of an index that at least keeps us in line with the federal minimum wage. I know when we discussed this back in 2003, we increased from about $5 to $7.15. It was a significant increase, and we were well several dollars above the federal minimum wage. And it really has, just going back to the issue of the impact on jobs, it had little impact on jobs. We heard that testimony. So I do feel strongly about the keeping it at least somewhat above the federal minimum wage. On the cost of living allowance, I think the problem that we have is costs for everyone increase every year, particularly for low-income Alaskans. And we know since 2003, costs have increased dramatically for fuel, for gas, for heating oil, for food. And so Alaskans are not keeping pace. And the problem that you have is when you try to increase it, as I mentioned, had we kept a cost of living allowance adjuster in the 2003 bill that the legislature passed, had we kept that in there, we'd be at 878 next year. We wouldn't even be here today. The problem that you have now is we're trying to go to 878, and people are saying, well, that's too big of a jump. And so you are never able to keep pace with inflation with that circular argument. And so I think this just takes the politics out of it. This is our way of saying, you know what, we're just going to index it every year. We're going to tick it up a little bit, and that's being fair to Alaskans. On the tip credit, I don't support it. It's not something that I support. I don't support taking wages out of the pockets of hardworking tip earners. It's just not something I philosophically support. It's not something that is found in many of the West Coast states, for instance. Washington, which next year will have a minimum wage projected to be at 878, does not have a tip credit. Oregon, to my knowledge, does not have a tip credit. I think in keeping pace with what the other states on the West Coast are doing, and in particular on this issue, is not something that I support, Mr. Chair.
Thank you much, Senator Wilikowski. Senator Meyer?
Just a couple questions, because you brought it up, Mr. Chairman. Do most states have a tip credit, though?
Many states do have a tip credit. In fact, I think you're right. Most states probably do have it.
Okay. And then if I could, Mr. Chairman, does the federal minimum wage, is that tied to an index? I mean, does it go up so much each year with inflation?
No. No. What they did with the federal minimum wage was they had a stair step. They had, it was, I think, 565, and they stair-stepped it up in either two or three tiers to the point where in July it will be $7.25.
Okay. Thanks.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Wilikowski. I know that we have 10 people that are waiting to testify. I don't know, is there anyone physically present here that would like to testify or are? Yes, I see. If you may, please.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to hear from administration before you begin taking general testimony, or are they here prepared to speak to this bill?
I believe the administration testified last Thursday.
They did last time.
Last Thursday.
So they have no further comment.
Is there anyone from the administration that would like to provide testimony at this time?
They said they were available for questions only.
No, we're just here for questions.
Okay. If there's any questions, they are available. So, ma'am. And in the hopes of us completing at approximately 2:15, we would like to have everyone keep their remarks within 3 minutes. So please identify yourself and state your affiliation.
Won't take me that long. I signed up on the sheet, I believe, to testify. My name is Marie Darlin. I am the coordinator of the AARP Capital City Task Force here in Juneau. And you already have a letter from the AARP office stating that we support this bill and encourage you to pass it and point out the fact that Alaska's cost of living, as most of you are well aware, is the highest in the nation. And as already been stated, Alaska has always had a cost of living increase over the years to be sure that we were above the national average, which, as has been pointed out, we soon will not be. And so, therefore, we are encouraging this change. And with the way that prices have gone up, as all of you are aware, it's becoming increasingly difficult for people to get by on the minimum wage. And also, we want to point out the fact that you have more seniors who more than likely, or retirees, are going to be going, if not already in the workforce, back in to some of these minimum wage types of positions just because they have to. And so, therefore, we support the increase in this.
Any questions for Ms. Darlin? Thank you very much, ma'am.
You're welcome.
Anyone else physically present in the room that would like to? I know that we have in the Anchorage LIO Jack Amon. Is Mr. Amon present from Anchorage LIO? How about a Pete Burns from Anchorage?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, who's this?
This is Jack Amon.
Yes, please, we've got your name. Would you state your affiliation?
Yes, I am owner of Marx Brothers Cafe and Marx Brothers Catering.
All right, and please provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While I believe the sponsor is well-intentioned, he has serious misconceptions about minimum wage and its effects on the hospitality industry. In the last hearing, Senator Wilikowski stated that 80% of his constituents supported an increase in the minimum wage. However, I wonder if the question posed asked if they would support a mandated wage increase for workers earning $20 an hour or more, the answer would be quite different. While the perception is that a minimum wage increase would help back-of-the-house employees, such as dishwashers, the opposite is true. The only benefit would accrue to our highest-paid employees. In all the times I have testified about this issue, I don't feel the legislature has really understood how our industry compensates our waitstaff. Hourly rates are not their main source of income. What shifts they work are more important than how long they work. Everybody wants to be there when a restaurant is busy. I also feel there is a lack of understanding of tipped income. The federal government has included a tip credit since the enactment of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Indeed, tipped income is required to be reported and is subject to matching FICA and ESC contributions. One-third of my taxable wage base is from tipped income. The restaurant industry operates on thin margins. Nationally, restaurants net between 7 to 9% of gross sales. Labor is a more significant expense, comprising an average of 20 to 30% of gross sales. The impact of this legislation will be disproportionately borne by our industry. Saying that increased costs can be passed on to consumers is a fallacy. In these uncertain and troubling economic times, dining out is considered a luxury, and increasing prices can directly lead to declines in business. It seems illogical to me to put upward pressure on wages when job losses are so alarming. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Amon? Mr. Amon, I have one question. When you say one-third of your income base is from declared tip income, by that, am I understanding you that one-third is explain the numbers. Where does the 715 fit in that?
The 715 is paid irregardless of that. So in addition to the wages that I'm paying, a third of my payroll and the taxes I'm subject to, the matching employer taxes I'm subject to, is derived from the tipped income earned by my employees.
So on the
truth of the matter is that it often happens that the tipped income is so great that employees generate a negative paycheck.
If for example, the wage is $10 an hour and one-third of that is tips, then that indicates to me approximately $3.50 would be tips, and then...
No, sir, you're misunderstanding.
You're
misunderstanding me completely. In addition to the $7.15 an hour that I'm already paying them, in the case of servers, it's more than a third. It's probably three times the wage base that is tipped income. And I'm saying overall, counting my back-of-the-house employees, it's still another third cost in payroll taxes because of the tipped income. It doesn't deduct the 715. It's the 1715 plus.
Yeah, right. I understand that it's 715 plus an additional one-third of the 715.
No. One-third of my entire gross payroll. That's
right.
Counting all the back-of-the-house employees, too, sir.
Thank you.
So you see what I'm saying? The effect on overall running my restaurant of the tipped income generates a significant increase in my payroll tax burden just from the tipped income. And if you take the proportion of that that's tipped employees, it's not a third of their wages. It's probably two to three times their wages.
Anyone else with a question for Mr. Amon? Thank you very much. We will now go to Mr. Dave Lambert at the Fairbanks LIO.
Hello, my name is Dave Lambert. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, and please identify your affiliation.
I contract with nonprofits to raise funds for them. I'm in a business that you guys have fixed the maximum price I can charge for items, so there's no raising prices. My employees survive on tips. I have employees at minimum wage claiming they make $80,000 a year. Most of my employees drive brand new vehicles, nicer than I can afford to own, and most of them make more money than I do with the tips. There needs to be some kind of standard in there to credit for tips. There's 39 states that that have a tip allowance. You know, I've been working at a job now for 30 years, and I would love that job to be guaranteed inflation-proofed. I mean, if you're going to do that for the minimum wage, I'm sure you're going to do the same thing for all the state contracts and everything else. So let's pass that first. But my business can't survive. When you guys fix the maximum price we can charge, there's nowhere to go. Our costs keep going up. Our insurance keeps going up. Our product keeps going up. There's no room. And the nonprofits are the ones that are going to suffer. Can I take any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Lambert. Anyone with questions for Mr. Lambert? Thank you, Mr. Lambert. In the off nets, there's Bob Carl.
Yeah, my name is Bob Carl. I own a restaurant that operates out in the Matanuska Valley in the Wasilla area. I employ approximately 27 people. And this past year, we've been just simply hammered with probably a 30% increase in freight costs. We are now looking at utility expenses that are just going through the roof. And when we look at this minimum wage increase, I'm just not sure how we're going to be able to bear it. The fact for our employees is approximately 80% of our employees still live at home. My feeling about minimum wage is that it's a learning wage, not meant to be a wage that you can live on. Somebody's got to teach kids how to get into the workforce. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. I mean, somebody's got to teach them accountability, responsibility, how to report to a job. I mean, most of the kids that we get that come to us are green. And, you know, right now I have I have nobody at the absolute minimum wage. I have 13 employees that are earning between $7.40 and $7.90 right now. And these are kids that probably started out with us at minimum wage, but as they became more proficient, we moved them up. And that's how people get rewarded in the real world. We have 8 employees that are earning between $8 and $8.40. We have 3 employees that earn between $9 and $9.25. And we have a couple of shift leaders that earn between $10 and $10.25, and then I have some upper management people. A lot of these jobs are not intended to be career jobs. They're jobs to learn, to be able to move forward and pursue other things. A lot of our kids are in high school or in their beginning years of college. And I think that the net effect of this minimum wage increase, I heard a few of the comments, was breaking up pretty bad on some of these studies that were being quoted earlier. I can only tell you what my net result will be, is that we will likely eliminate somewhere from our 27 hourly employees, we will eliminate somewhere between 5 and 7 jobs, and we're just going to have to figure out how to do it in a different way. I parrot the same comments that these other gentlemen have made about our industry is so price sensitive. We can't just simply pass all of these costs on. We've already had to absorb the freight costs and now utility costs and now a potential of additional labor costs. It's just becoming untenable. And the idea that you're raising the boat for everybody, how about small businesses that aren't even going to be able to stay in business? What is the beyond stage one thinking? What if this drives me out of business? There's 27 jobs gone. That really accomplished a lot.
All right.
Well, that's basically my testimony. I'm absolutely against it. And it's a pretty tough environment we're operating in out here right now.
Thank you, Mr.
Likely
Carl.
To get worse. This indexing with inflation.
Mr. Carl.
I mean, with what the national is doing right now, inflation could run away here pretty soon. And this indexing with inflation, 6-7%.
Yes, Mr. Carl.
I just don't know what would happen.
Hello, Mr. Carl.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. We're trying to limit it to 3 minutes, and so I thank you. Any questions for Mr. Carl? Seeing none, we'll return now to the Anchorage LIO, Pete Burns. Pete Burns, are you available?
Hello, this is actually Bruce Burnett. Pete Burns is my general manager. My name is Bruce Burnett.
All right, Bruce, state your affiliation.
My affiliation is I'm the owner of the TGI Fridays franchise restaurant here in Anchorage, Alaska.
All right, thank you, Mr. Burnett. Please provide your testimony.
Well, I'm just amazed that Mr. Walalinski or whatever, his point that he's against the tip share. The Princeton studies would be New Jersey. They have a tip credit. Most of the Harvard, they have a tip credit in that town. And it was misconstrued that we were the number one highest place to live. Anchorage, Alaska isn't. Hawaii, it costs more to live in Hawaii. San Francisco, I'm sure there's other places. We do have a high cost of living. However, there, and also it was misstated, there were 39 states. Approximately 90% of the states in the United States have a tip credit. I believe it's 46 out of 50 states. In any event, I'm trying to, because we have short time, I could talk to you forever, but some of the things is brought out. Our fuel costs have gone up over 30% in Anchorage in the last year. All the other things the gentleman brought attention, we work on a very, very small margin. People in our restaurant, the least paid front of the house, which would be your servers, as well as your hostess. Your hostess are just people that sit people down. They're high school, college students. They're making approximately $15 an hour. So to add a couple dollars an hour to that, we were talking, one of the gentlemen said we make approximately 7 to 9% pre-tax. If everything goes perfect in this town, without your bill would cost me approximately 2% of that bottom line, which is totally unacceptable. We employ approximately 100 people. We would have to let one manager go and probably somewhere between 12 to 15 people because it just gets to a point where you can't afford everything. Our cost of shipping is 4% higher than any store in the lower 48 states. TGI Fridays closed their restaurant, as well as Olive Garden closed one of their restaurants in Hawaii. Same problem, shipping, 5%. So there's a lot of things that, Bill, you're not looking at. This industry needs a tip credit drastically. We cannot live with this bill the way that it is. You will lose many hundreds of jobs. I haven't done a study on it. I don't know how many, but I'm sure it's many hundreds of jobs without a tip share credit being passed in this state. That's basically all I have to say. I hope there are some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Any questions from the committee? Mr. Burnett, very quickly, in maybe 30 seconds, when you say tip credit, what is it that you have in mind? I've heard people mention tip credit, but they've not mentioned an application.
Well, in other states, let's say Texas, Florida, et cetera, they're down to where the actual wage is down to 213. I wouldn't suggest that, but certainly we should at least freeze the wages where they are for the hospitality industry.
All right, thank you, Mr. Burnett. We now move to Fairbanks LIO. Gloria Bursell, are you present? Gloria Bursell.
Hi, do you hear me? I'm here.
Yes, please state your name and identify your affiliation.
Okay, my name is Gloria Bursell, and my husband and I, Bob Bursell, own a restaurant here in Fairbanks, Alaska. We are against this bill. As everyone previous to me has stated, it will definitely hurt our business. The very people, the only people that make minimum wage in our restaurant are the wait staff. They make the most money per hour than any other employee in our restaurant, and our top paid people make $15 an hour. The last time I was in this room was in the fall, wondering how we were going to make it through winter because of the high gas prices. And now you plan on, you know, raising our expenses through an hourly wage increase. we will have to do something. We will have to cut jobs. We will have to do something. There isn't any other way to make it. And let's see, my husband wanted me to give you a quote. In his opinion, it's empty, shallow thinking, feel-goodism. It shows a general lack of understanding of our economic system. Anyways, that's what I have to say. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Gloria Purcell? Seeing none, we'll move to Tammy Griffin at the OffNets site. Tammy Griffin.
Good afternoon. My name is Tammy Griffin, and I am the current chair of the Alaska Hotel and Lodging Association, and I also am a director of operations for a hotel management company. We have 7 properties in Alaska, and I am a lifelong Alaskan and have myself lived on tips alone. As my start in the industry was in a family business where we didn't get a paycheck. We only received tips. But I've heard a lot of different quotes and comments this afternoon, and I certainly appreciate everyone taking the time to be heard because this is a very important subject. From the Wage and Hour Division of the United States Department of Labor website, we've heard a lot of quotes today, but looking at their website as of January 1, 2009, which lists out the minimum wages for tipped employees in the states who have a tip credit incorporated to their minimum wage. We currently have 43 states that offer a definition of tipped employees and minimum dollar amounts that they can make so that no tipped employee would ever go below a minimum wage with their earnings entered. Most states actually have a $20 per hour or even $30 per hour listed or specified, which I think all of you agree would be far more than what would be considered poverty or a livable wage. From the 2007 Wage Watch survey sponsored by the Alaska Hotel Alliance, we have on this report, there are literally 0 job classifications within the hotel industry that are at or even close to minimum wage other than tipped employees. Because quite honestly, in this business, you cannot hire housekeepers for minimum wage. That's not what we pay. And those that are on minimum wage are absolutely tipped employees. They are the highest paid. I worked for the Captain Cook for 17 years, and there was not one year that I made more than any of my bellmen. And I worked all the way through the company up to director of room operations. And even at that level of seniority and wages, which I felt were very fair, I guarantee you every one of my bellmen made more than I did. So we're not speaking about the lowest paid wage employees in our market. We are talking about giving a raise to the highest paid individuals in our businesses.
All right, thank you, Tammy Griffin. We are trying to keep the testimony to 3 minutes. We may not be able to get through everyone today, but are there any questions of Tammy Griffin? Seeing none, we'll move to Pat Luby at the Anchorage LIO. Pat Luby, Anchorage LIO, are you available? Okay. How about Bob Wynn, Anchorage LIO?
I am here, but I believe Dale Fox from Alaska Char was above me on the list. I wonder if I could pass to him.
Who is there?
Dale Fox from Alaska Char.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Fox, please state your name and affiliation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dale Fox, and I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Char. We represent restaurants, hotels, bars, and package stores across our great state. I'm here today to speak against Senate Bill 1. When we look at the current economic climate, there's a national economic crisis out there, which many people in Alaska think has passed us by. But let's take a look at a few of the factors. Causing slow bookings for the tourism industry. We're going to feel it hard this summer. Retail sales are down to lowest in years. Unemployment's the highest in 5 years. Restaurants are seeing their seventh consecutive month of declines. Some of my members say, and you're hearing as well, that revenues are down significantly and expenses are up. Most of the minimum wage employees in the state, according to the information Senator Wilichowski produced, are tipped employees, are young people who are growing job skills. Many people like to believe that Alaska has avoided the most of the housing crisis and our economy is better than the southern states, and therefore it's rosy. What I'm hearing from my members is that it is emphatically not, particularly in the restaurant arena. Last week you heard from a restaurateur in Fairbanks saying his revenues were down 25%. I've heard people tell me privately that their revenues are down even more. Our national government and most state governments around the nation are looking for ways to help the economy recover. A huge minimum wage increase at this time would be a step in the wrong direction. I encourage you to read the NFIB report that was received in your packet last week. And on behalf of the many hardworking small businesses in Alaska, I encourage you not to move this bill out of committee and to consider tip credit as an option for those that are not the lowest paid workers, but often the highest paid workers, as you've heard. We've heard from our members that an average wait person in a restaurant is making $40,000, $50,000, even $60,000 a year in tips alone. So hardly the lowest paid person. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Fox? Seeing none, we'll move to the Fairbanks LIO. Larry Hackenmiller, is Hack available?
Yes, this is Larry Hackenmiller, and today I'm with the National Federation of Independent Businesses. I'm a member for over 20.
Hello, did we lose the...
No, I'm here. I went green and then red. Larry Hackenmiller, I'm a member, been a member of the NFIB for over 20 years. And I'm also a small businessman, and I'm here to speak, and I can't understand why in this particular bill, when the sponsors are so against tipping credit, yet they're using the poverty level as their argument to increase. And we can show them that these people that are tipped in Alaska are doing well above the poverty level, yet they're not even bringing this to the table or back to the table to discuss. It doesn't give me a lot of credibility. I would really support this bill if it stayed in this committee the rest of this session. It would really do good there. But when it comes to the tipping, we ever heard about that. As far as the economist goes that drew this up, you know, these were comments made in 2006, and these are Nobel Peace Prize-winning economists, and this is 2009, and those guys have probably been at the helm the last 3 years as well. So I wouldn't put a lot of credit in that. And as far as the consumer price index goes, it is inflationary when you connect it to that. I don't know why it has to be connected to begin with. I'm going to have to pay more workman's comp because that's based on my gross salaries, labor, my payroll, more Fed taxes and state taxes. And the only reason why this dollar and a half per hour came up is because the sponsors already looked at attaching a CPI years ago to where they're saying, well, it's 8.78. So they're getting a deal. We're saving 3 cents because it wasn't connected to it. And then the sponsors all saying, that's too big of a jump. Well, what is too big of a jump? Where did the buck and a half come from other than being tied into a CPI drawing from years ago? Where did the buck and a half come from? Where did the 50 cents come from? And trust me, when it comes to poverty level, okay, you aren't dealing with the 7% that you say that are making minimum wage or less. Those economists are dealing with the 93%, and they have no idea what a small business is or hard around small business. They don't deal in that tiny of numbers. And the studies are flawed because you've heard from restaurant people here today of what they've already done with increasing prices.
All right,
and increasing
this
is not going to help.
All right. Thank you, Hack, for your testimony. We do want to end the public testimony at this time. It is approximately 2:15, and so I know there were a few people that did want to also provide telephonic testimony, but I would encourage anyone that if they would send a letter or an email to me or any one of the committee members on this Labor and Commerce Committee, or send a email or letter to their legislator and ask them to forward that to me so that we can make that part of the official record. I'm going to hold a Senate bill today, and we will take a brief at ease, and we will then take up Senate Bill 23. We will continue in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee Thursday, February 12th, and we now have before us Senate Bill 23, and we have the bill's sponsor, Senator Elton. Would you please take the witness seat and identify yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I only have 12 or 15 pages of prepared remarks. And for the record, my name is Kim Elton, and despite what you may have read in the newspapers, I'm still the senator from District B, of Juneau. And I really do appreciate the privilege of again introducing this bill to another committee. This is SB 23. It's an iteration of a bill that was before the Senate last year. And it is an exact replica of the bill that was considered last year. I'm going to do something with permission of the chair. I think the packet pretty much speaks to the elements of the bill, the details of the bill. So in my prepared remarks, I just want to talk a little bit about kind of the history and the rationale for the bill with the permission of the chair.
Please proceed, Senator Elton.
And some of this is going to be repetitive, but 4 years ago, a previous legislature passed, and the previous governor signed SB 141. That's a bill that created kind of this brand spanking new defined contribution retirement system for teachers in the TERS program and for public employees, state and municipal employees in the PERS program. The net result of SB 141 is that the plan shifted risk from the state to new and future teachers and public employees. One of the major impetuses, most of you were here for that debate, and I think you'll probably remember that one of the major impetuses for the new DC plan was the existing, at the time, unfunded liability in both the TERS plan and the PERS plan. That unfunded liability, I think at the time, and if memory serves me correctly, it was about 70% in both plans. And That essentially, the 70% figure essentially is how much we would be short. We'd be short 30% if every employee quit the next day that was a member of the plans. And that's essentially what an unfunded liability means. It's what happens if everybody quits at once. And maybe an analogy that is more familiar to people is a family's unfunded liability, if they have a home. Their unfunded liability would be how much do they have in their savings if the bank the next day pulls the note on their mortgage. I mean, if they have 70% in savings to cover the note, that's actually pretty good. It's not as good in a retirement plan. But the unfunded liability figure, while we attach a great deal of importance to it, it's really a figure that actuaries use so they can make a determination on whether or not the employer or the employee needs to be putting more money into their plans so that you can kind of control the liability that's out there. It's very rare that any plan is 100% or more than 100% funded. It's ideal, but it's rare. I think it's important to note here, perhaps too, that by adopting SB 141 in 2005, we didn't fix the unfunded liability problem. I mean, the adoption of a DC plan did nothing and does nothing to reduce the unfunded liability. I think too that another reason the DC plan kind of squeaked through in a special session, I mean, it took a special session to finally get it accomplished, is an argument that was true on its face, but not quite so true in its application. I'm using euphemisms. I tried to avoid saying true on its face, but dishonest in its application. Advocates of the DC plan noted that a DC plan saved the state money when compared to the defined benefits plans. And the plural on plans is important to note, because I don't disagree with that statement. You compare the new DC plan that we debated in 2005 to the defined benefit plans, and the statement is true. DC saves you money. But it obscured a central fact that was very important to the debate. The debate should have been whether or not the new defined contribution plan saved the employers, the state, school districts, saved them money if compared to Tier 3 in the PERS plan and Tier 2 in the TERS plan. And the answer to that question is no, it was probably a wash, didn't save anything. And it's important to note that Tier 1 PERS, I am one. I mean, what a Cadillac plan. Great plan. But it's a plan that has been closed for 20 years. And so new employees were not going into Tier 1. New employees were going into Tier 3. And those employees, the employer cost for those new employees is essentially the same whether it's DC or the old Tier 3. Same on the TERS side, whether it's the new DC plan for teachers or the old Tier 2 DB plan for teachers. I just kind of an additional note. I'm trying to avoid using an awful lot of numbers as I make the presentation here. But I think it's probably, to illustrate the point I just made, it's important to note that the unfunded liability for a Tier 1 PERS person is 13 times the unfunded liability for a Tier 3 PERS person. And there are almost exactly the same number of employees or retirees in the Tier 1 plan as there are on the Tier 3 plan. So Tier 1, again, I consider myself fortunate to be one. Tier 1 is a great plan, a Cadillac plan. And that is what kind of created the vast, vast majority of the unfunded liability. I think that it's also important to note that, you know, it wasn't just the unfunded liability debate that we had in 2005. It was also a debate on employer costs. I mean, how much is it going to cost a school district or a municipality or the state government as the employer? How much would it cost them to contribute to a DC plan as compared to contributing to the old Tier 3 or Tier 2 plans? And it's almost a wash. It was almost a wash then. It's almost a wash now. You'll see new numbers, I think. The state has just received new numbers from Buck Consultants, actuaries, that demonstrate that the employer contribution to the DC plan on the PERS side is slightly lower than the employer contribution to the old Tier 3 plan. On the TERS, it's the opposite. On the TERS plan, the employer contribution now to the new DC plan for teachers is slightly higher than the contribution that was made to the old Tier 2 plan for teachers. And I think you're going to see here in the next couple of days probably the graph and the charts that illustrate that, you know, we're talking about slight differences here in cost, one slightly up, the other slightly down. But I hope you also take time to read some of the verbiage that accompanies those charts. And I'm going to read a statement by the actuary. Quote, for both PERS and TERS, the normal cost rate of the DB plan is less than the DC employer contribution rate. Let me read that again. Here's what the actuary says. For both PERS and TERS, the normal cost rate of the DB plan is less than the DC employer contribution rate. Just while we're on this point, I just want to make another comparison. It's not that we just have to rely on what the actuaries are telling us, the professional pension folks are telling us. There's experience elsewhere. A couple of jurisdictions, a couple of states, had gone to a DC plan well before the state of Alaska did. And here is their experience. When Nebraska had a DC plan for 20 years, they went back to a DB plan because it was less expensive. In West Virginia had gone to a defined contribution plan for teachers, and they went back to a DB plan because it was cheaper. So the discussion and the talk that we had 4 years ago about cost, I mean, I think it's easier to have those cost discussions now because we're dealing with more facts. And the facts and the experience elsewhere demonstrates that going back to a DB plan is not going to be expensive. We already know it doesn't do anything to lower the unfunded liability that the plans have. Now, at the risk of going into too much detail, I want to go back to what I said a couple of minutes ago. A couple of minutes ago, I said that savings to the state for the new DC plan was essentially a wash. And my analysis at that point when I said that was pretty narrow because it spoke only to employer contributions. It spoke only to the new and old retirement plans and what the employer cost of those plans were. But there are significant, sometimes quantifiable, sometimes not quite so quantifiable, losses that the state incurs with a defined contribution plan. And I want to speak to two of them because they're, I think, easily understood and they're very pertinent to the discussion. The two that I'm going to speak to are recruitment and retention. New employees, smart new employees, talented new employees, tend to think ahead when they make a decision about where they're going to work and what they're going to do and who they're going to do it for and who they provide services to. Those smart, talented new employees can make a choice. I mean, they can work for the feds, they can work for another state, they can work for municipalities outside the state of Alaska. And if they make that choice, I mean, I think one of the things that they will consider is is, should I work in Alaska where there is no defined benefit plan, or should I work for a public employer that has two defined benefit plans? The first defined benefit plan would be the one that's provided by the other public employers. The second defined benefit plan would be the Social Security plan. We're not competitive anymore. Alaska has neither of those safety net defined benefit plans. So I think that does get in the way when a new person is deciding where they're going to go to work. I mean, if a police department in Lansing, Michigan, or a police department in Juneau, Alaska is recruiting somebody, I mean, hopefully they're different than I was when I was first employed. When I was first employed, hey, I didn't think about retirement. I didn't think about the benefits. I didn't start doing that until I got married. I didn't start thinking about that until I bought a home. I hope new employees are different than I was. Now, retention. We created a real problem with retention when we went to defined contribution. I think the nub of this is how do you keep a new state employee or school district employee or municipal employee, how do you keep them on the farm once you hire them? We created an incentive for them to leave because they can stay for 5 years. Maybe they get to 28, they're married, they're starting to wonder how they can afford a house in Juneau. I don't want to cast aspersions at anybody else's community, but Juneau housing is expensive. They want a family. They're trying to decide whether to buy, whether it's a two or a three bedroom or a four bedroom home, and after 5 years, we've made that decision for them to leave easier, because they can take the money they put into the defined contribution plan, they can take the money the employer put into the defined contribution plan. They can go someplace else outside the boundaries of the state of Alaska. They have a nice nest egg of money they can use as a down payment on a home, and they can find an employer that will give them a defined benefit, give them two defined benefits, Social Security and what every other public employer around the nation does. I've got a couple of other things here, but I'm going to skip ahead and I'm going to anticipate a question based on arguments that we no longer an argument we no longer need to anticipate. And that argument, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, goes like this. PERS TERS changes are complex, and they deserve all the time we need to study, to review, to talk to professionals. It takes a lot of time. Let's not hurry. Let's not rush. It's kind of a wait, don't hurry argument. One that is, I think, often made in all honesty. One that is sometimes made because we know it's easier to kill a bill than to pass a bill. We know it's even easier to kill a bill in 90 days than it is to kill a bill in 121 days. So I think the argument is often used honestly, sometimes used by opponents. But the argument is flawed on several levels. And the first is, we're not creating something new with this bill. There is nothing in this bill that isn't already in law. There were some good things that happened in the DC bill, some tweaks actuarially and others that were good. This bill doesn't change those. This bill doesn't create something new in law. It doesn't change Tier 3. It just says new employees are going to go to Tier 3 if they're a PERS employer, or Tier 2 if they're a TERS employer. Nothing new. I mean, the state is managing a Tier 3 and a Tier 2 plan for PERS employees and TERS employees. Nothing new. So So that is one of the things that would mitigate against the argument of, wait, you know, don't hurry. The second argument is that this year, last year, the year before that, we are able to talk about facts and figures. When we passed the defined contribution plan in 2005, we were talking and debating concepts. I mean, we didn't have the numbers that we now have. We didn't have managers back then coming to tell us that, hey, it's tough out there to hire a firefighter or a teacher. And part of the reason it's tough is because we're not competitive on a benefits package. And you know, unfortunately, we're not competitive on wages in many cases. So I don't think we need to wait, don't hurry, because we've got facts and figures that I think can lead us to a good conclusion and I think speak to support for this bill. Another argument that mitigates against the wait approach, and that is it's not like we're starting the debate on this bill right now at the first hearing in the Senate. I mean, this is a debate that has happened outside the walls of this building for 3 years. It's happened in constituent meetings. It's happened during campaigns. It's a debate that has been going on for a long time prior to this moment right here. And it's important to note where that debate occurred. It occurred outside the building, but it also occurred inside the building. This bill moved through two committees in the previous legislature. I mean, so we began the debate. We're not beginning it now. We began it last year. Finally, the fourth reason the wait, don't hurry argument gets my goat. I had to think about how I was going to say this before I got down here. And I decided the safest way of saying this, but it gets my goat, because the take our time, you know, before contemplating going back to a plan that we already have. Let's remember some history here. The history behind the defined contribution plan is that in 2005, the legislature adopted a DC contribution plan. The Senate discussion and debate on that brand new plan. This isn't a plan that was off the shelf from some other jurisdiction. This isn't a plan that actuaries had prepared or pension professionals had prepared. This was a plan that politicians like me prepared, elected officials. The debate going to a radical, brand spanking new retirement plan, that debate lasted for 28 days in the Senate before the bill was passed. 28 days. I just leave you with this final thought. If we can adopt a radical, brand spanking new pension plan that nobody else had, no other public jurisdiction had, if we can do that in 28 days, and I don't want to sound sarcastic here, but it may come across that way, it would seem to me that we can make a decision to utilize a pension plan that's already on the books that we've had 20 years of experience with. We ought to be able to make that decision in 2 weeks. Let's not fall into the trap that this is complicated stuff, we're creating something new. We're not creating anything new. We're just going back to a plan that we had for 20 years, a plan that doesn't cost employers more, a plan that doesn't inflate the unfunded liability, but also a plan that provides a secure and safe retirement. It provides a benefit package for retirees that won't die before they do. And I would suggest that's very, very important, because the retirement economy in the state of Alaska is a $1.5 billion economy. Those are dollars that are spent in restaurants and drugstores, hospitals, car lots, to landlords, and we don't want to stick with a plan in which a brand new retiree says, okay, this isn't quite as if this is a lot more iffy than a defined benefit package. Maybe I should live someplace where the cost of living isn't higher by a factor of 1.36 than it is in Anchorage, you know, Fairbanks, Kenai, Mat-Su, and considerably higher than that in bush communities. I'm prepared to answer some questions. If you have questions for me, I'm going to invite my staff person, Jesse Keel, to sit at the microphone here with me. I don't want to suggest that Jesse knows more about this than I do, but at my age, I suspect he remembers more about it than I do. So if there are any questions from the committee, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
I don't see any questions, but Senator Elton, thank you very much. I'd like to confirm, is Michael Lamb on the phone? Michael Lamb?
Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Yes. Anyway, we will be coming to you in one moment, but I understand that Kevin Brooks and Pat Shire are here. In the event we had any questions, I would request that they defer at the moment so that we I understand it was questions, if we had questions, but we can do that later. So Michael Lamb, would you please state your name for the record and your affiliation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Lamb. I am currently and have been the Chief Financial Officer for the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and have spent actually a great deal of time researching and reflecting on the systems and the issues that got it into the unfunded state that we find ourselves in now. I need to be sure and make clear and convey two conversations I've had with the mayor to be sure that it's very clear that the mayor's office nor the assembly have taken up officially, had any discussions on the DB versus DC issue. And so the comments that I have to share right now are not Fairbanks North Star Borough comments, but are my comments, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to make sure that we were clear on that.
Thank you, Mr. Lamb. We understand that.
Thank you. I also, after listening to Senator Elton, I want to make sure that he and I have not talked, because a lot of the points that he raised, I'm not going to raise as many, because of regard to time and all the issues that you're here to hear, but we concur on a lot of the things that have been said. And I want to also clear from the front, given my involvement in this issue since it became blew up several years ago, I spent a lot of time through the years in the PERS and TERS, and I fully acknowledge and am very respectful that there are differing views and valid views on this whole issue that's being discussed today. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to share some of my thoughts. As I said, I've reflected a lot about this through the years. And first thing I'm going to say with regards to Senate Bill 23 is that I do concur with several of the points that is in the sponsor statement. And he talked about them a little bit today. Specifically, recruitment and retaining employees is an issue. It has been an issue, and it will become a bigger issue as the boomer demographics changes continue to occur. Secondly, most public employees are, new ones, are put, I believe, into a greater risk as relates to their retirement capabilities using individual savings plans. Because of the sponsor states, these accounts earn much less than professionally managed pension funds. And thirdly, I do agree also that the oversight has been beefed up substantially in the systems with the two actuaries and all the other improvements. So even though I could expound on a lot of different things, there's probably four main points that I'd like to make. The first one is, and this may be a departure from Senator Altman or anyone else, but if it was my choice, I would actually continue both plans. The development of both plans have been paid for, and they are both being maintained. I do concur that, and it is my position, that in most instances, the DB plan, I believe, should be used. But I think that there are also occasions where it is beneficial to both the employee and the employer for a particular employer to enter into a DC plan. For example, many short-term employees that intend to be short-term are better off in a DC plan. In fact, when Melanie Milhorn was the director and Charlie Morrison was the CFO for the Department of Administration, the retirement benefits, they did analysis, and I believe it showed that, I can't remember, within 15 or 17 years, an individual was better off in a DC plan if they got out of a plan. So are those individuals, employees, that may be short-term intended in terms of being an employee in the system, I think a DC plan provides a good option. I think that employees that have actually retired from the DP plan and that could go back and provide service to employers once they've retired should only be allowed to come back and be part of a DC plan. We, for example, have employees that come back that have retired, that worked actually in my department, for my department, as audit temps in the summer. They have a lot of experience. They decide that they're willing to come back and work, which is great. And a DC plan is the simplest way to do that. Second point, besides having continuation of both plans, is that the cost to the employer of a DB and a DC plan are about the same. I have come to the same conclusion that Senator Elton has come to. And depending upon what year you're talking about, the DB plan, in fact, might be cheaper. The fiscal year 10 normal cost rate, I'm only talking about the normal cost rate, is to be 9.46 for PERS as compared to a DC rate of slightly over 10%. And this, of course, that number depends upon what the health reimbursement arrangement amount turns out to be. But it is around 10 or slightly. Further, in the DB plan, if an employee leaves before they are vested, the employer's contribution into the plan on behalf of that employee over their employment period remains with the plan. Thirdly, PERS created, from my view of the world, a short-term problem, then I look at it as a midterm problem, and then I look at it as a long-term issue. And some of these have actually been addressed, but this is the way that I look at it. The short-term issue, which we're all dealing with right now, really was the impact to all of our budgets across the state because of the increased cost that resulted from the very large change in the past service cost rate. That component of the rate that paid for and is paying for the unfunded obligation. The midterm issue is focused around our ability as entities to actually be competitive in the marketplace and hire and retain employees to provide the programs and the services that we're charged with delivering. I believe we've begun to feel the effects, actually for a while now, of this hiring and retainage issue. I believe that without reinstating a DB option, I'm quite fearful that our abilities to hire and retain will only get progressively worse. In the long term, and I'm talking decades out, but in the long term, I really fear that not going back to a DB plan will surely create a situation where another huge component of our population will not be prepared for retirement, and will in the end actually cost the government, in this case the state of Alaska and our entities, more money to provide assistance to them than if the government had managed a DB plan on their behalf in the first place. This whole issue, the underpinnings of my thoughts about this, is analogous to the discussions that occurred several years ago when some wanted a portion of employees' pay to not go into the Social Security system, which is in fact a DB plan, but to be individually managed. What recent times should have made abundantly clear is that there are very few individuals that are knowledgeable enough, that are informed enough, that are disciplined enough, that are long-term horizon enough to set up and manage a multi-decade retirement plan with proper allocation of their assets, should they have been disciplined enough to set aside a proper amount on a continuous basis throughout their lifetime. I'm fearful that even with a well-set-up DC plan, most individuals are, in fact, emotional investors, the result being that they'll be ill-prepared financially for retirement. A DB plan is a great equalizer for hardworking persons who don't have the time, the knowledge, or the inclination to diligently manage their retirement funds over decades. The fourth point, which I think is important to make because I think it will end up weighing in a lot of legislators' minds with regards to the decision about the DB versus the DC. And the fourth point I want to make really kind of revolves around the concept of sunk cost. And what I have to say is that the existing unfunded liability issue really is not relevant in this decision. For this position and statement to not be true, for what I said to not be true, one would have to be willing to argue that future normal cost rates are going to be set lower than they should be by the actuary. The rate an individual employer pays, as we know, is comprised of two components, the normal cost rate and the past service cost rate. When the normal cost rate is set properly, there is no need for a supplemental past service cost rate. If normal cost rates had been set properly in prior years, there would be no past service cost component, or it would be an immaterial amount, and there would be no discussion with regards to PERS and TERS. Essentially, when the normal cost rate is set, and it's set properly, and we pay that amount throughout the year, it doesn't matter whether we end stop service as an entity and all those employees are gone, whether somebody retires or not. But if that amount is set properly, then the amount of funding that should be available in those future decades to provide the payments should be there. The unfunded liability that drives this discussion so often, that in fact drove going to a DC plan, which I think was the analysis of what caused it, I do not believe is correct, because the research I did came to the same conclusion that Senator Elton stated also, that if you go back and you look at the amount of unfunded obligations, they reside, the vast majority of them come from Tier 1 retirements, which also ended 20 years ago. The unfunded liability, which a lot of people thought about and I'm sure are going to be concerned about right now, was not driven by investment problems. And many people believe that. But Callan Associates conveyed on 1020 of 06 to the ARM board that PERS and TERS have achieved annualized total returns of 8.89 and 8.96 respectively. The expected rate of return on the investments to pay those future benefits is 8.25. And in the 2 years after Callan had done their analysis, the rates of return were, as I recall, something like 17 or 19%. The Department of Revenue does an outstanding job professionally managing the state's fund, including the retirement funds. There is, and I have it here, and I could go through it if you wanted to, but there is substantial testimony that has been made to the legislature on the fact that the unfunded cost was really driven by actuarial miscalculations. There is a report that was done by the Alaska Division of Legislative Audit in January of 06 that stated the same thing. If you look at the lawsuit that was filed by the ARM Board against Mercer, it states clearly that they made Mercer, here's what it's nevertheless, made fundamental errors in methodology and even in basic calculations and failed to assign competent, experienced personnel. the whole history of the unfunded obligation, which I'm fearful will become the hinge pin of where decisions get made of moving on and not moving on, really would have never occurred and really has no impact on the future as long as the normal cost rates are correct. And as we talked about, or I said in the very beginning, and as is noted in the sponsor statement, that Alaska has beefed up its oversight of the pension system. I have a lot of difficulty imagining in the near term, the next decade or whatever, that we're going to take our eyes off of what the actuary produces. And if that's the case, then we're right back to, does a DB plan cost more than a DC plan, which gets to the basic question of, is the normal cost rate higher than the DC cost? And the projection for next year for PERS, 9.46, is lower. So in short, let me just restate that unless you believe the future normal cost rates are going to be set as irresponsibly as those brought forth by Mercer in the late 90s, the existing unfunded liability is not relevant to a DB versus a DC discussion. And again, I still believe that, quite frankly, I've been the CFO for almost 20 years, that we have two tools that have been set up, they're established, they're maintained, and in my world, we would have both available with the majority of employees going into the DB plan. Time is short, Mr. Chairman, and that will conclude my comments, and I'd be happy to address any questions should there be any.
We intend upon, Mr. Lamb, thank you very much. We would hope that you might be available for questions next Thursday, I believe, when we will take this up again. Would that be possible?
I have assembly meeting that night, but I do believe that I can do that.
All right. Before I conclude at 3 o'clock, I understand that there's been a Mr. Garcia that's traveled from Eagle River, and so I just out of the fact that he is he's traveled here for purpose of his comment, I want to make sure that before we close out today, we give him, so please take the witness.
Can we have a written copy of this testimony?
Yes, would you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
My name is Daniel Garcia. I'm a police officer with the Anchorage Police Department.
Okay, and
I just wanted to, I appreciate Senator Elton's statements, and all of his concerns are what my concerns are. I came to Alaska in 2005. I was a law clerk for a Superior Court judge in Anchorage. I was a temporary full-time employee, so I wasn't in PERS at that point. I was paying into SBS, but not into PERS. When I concluded my clerkship in August of 2006, I went to the district attorney's office in Anchorage, where I was an assistant district attorney there. In November of so I was Tier 4 by a month or month and a half. I went to the Anchorage Police Department in November of 2007, and I've been there since. The Anchorage Police Department Employees Association, for that association, which represents over 500 members, we have approximately 100 Tier 4 members. My academy class, we graduated 25. I think 23 of those were Tier 4. Myself, I'll vest in 2.5 years, and at that point, I'll have 3.5 years of police experience. And for myself, that experience, and with a law degree licensed in Colorado and Alaska, I could take that experience and go, as Senator Elton said, to the feds, to anywhere. I love Alaska. I'm starting a family in Alaska. I don't want to leave, but I may be forced to. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, just a quick one, and I appreciate you're here. But I understand APD is now, because of the economic downturn in the lower 48, having plenty of applicants of experienced police officers who are actually coming to work in Alaska. Is that correct?
We had a meeting in Anchorage a little while back where Sergeant, who is the director of recruiting, actually testified there, and he testified that recruiting for Anchorage Police Department has gotten extremely or more and more difficult as Tier 4 has come into effect. Recruiting and retention as far as police officers in Anchorage, which is the largest police department in the state, is a big concern for the department. And yes, there are a lot of applicants, but qualified applicants is a different story. When you have 1,000 applicants and only hire 30 of those applicants.
Well, I understand, and we want the best and brightest, but maybe I didn't ask my question accurately. Was the news account inaccurate that the APD is hiring experienced police officers from the lower 48 because they're looking for jobs?
Are you asking, does the Anchorage Police Department hire lateral officers and officers who have experience? Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia, for your testimony, and thank you for coming from Eagle River. And I also understand, with the indulgence of the committee, it's 3 o'clock now, but I understand that there's a Mr. Brett Gilland that's here from Anchorage, flew in for this. So if Mr. Gilland, you would be very brief, state your name and affiliation.
Yes, my name is Brett Gilland, and I am a teacher at West High School in Anchorage. Teacher recruitment, especially highly qualified math, special ed, science, is incredibly difficult. You can ask around to any of your schools. It is hard to find anyone who can teach in those specialties, which means the crux of this for them is how well do you retain your teachers. And I came up here, like so many do, saying, hey, I want to experience Alaska. I just got married. Let's see what's there. And we're coming up, and we love it. And we know Alaska may get its hooks in us, but I can absolutely guarantee you that within 10 years, if I don't have defined benefits, I'll take the money I've invested and the money that you guys have invested with me, and I will go somewhere that will give me a safe retirement. And I'm not looking for a Cadillac system, though that might be nice. I know you guys can't afford that, but I have to be safe in my retirement. In order for that to happen. And the future I see, and one that certainly looks to be headed this direction, is more and more of what I think of as mercenary teachers who come up and spend their 5-6 years, enjoy the state of Alaska, and then take your money right out of the state and right out of your economy and go spend it somewhere else where they have the surety of a defined benefit retirement, and then they can use your money to see if they can make some on top. And I'm very concerned about that, because while it may work out for me to go somewhere else, unfortunately, I cannot imagine that it is a good thing for the state of Alaska's finances, and I can guarantee you it is an awful, awful trend for your schools. You lose your leadership.
Thank you, Mr. Gillen. Any questions? I would like to thank all the people that did testify today, and thank the people who off-site have listened in. We will be holding the bill today. Obviously, we will be taking hopefully a lot more public testimony on this next week. And so, again, we're holding the bill, but this meeting is adjourned.